Blog Talk Radio.
John Talk Radio tonight. This is our August the 8th, 2015 show. Our special guest tonight is Rebel House Radio. Who do we have on the line with Rebel House Radio?
Hey there. This is
hey,
Mike. How you doing, man?
Doing good.
This is Mike Blumberg and Mike Mangan.
Yeah, so to avoid confusion, you can just refer to us as Mike M or Mike B, if that helps.
You know, I was when you guys called in, I was going to say Mike because I would have gotten it right, no matter if it had been wrong.
You probably get that right half the time just saying it to anybody, any man.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you guys on. I just want to tell you thanks, and I appreciate it. I really enjoy your music, and I'm looking forward to the show and talking about your upcoming album or the one that's out now, One More Day, and we just heard a cut from that, which was Can't Say No. And so thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you. We're glad to be here.
Honored.
Now, what I like to do in these shows, and I've been doing this since 2008, and I really enjoy talking to musicians and just getting the music out there and the story out there. And I like for people that go into the podcast and listen to it to be able to tell, you know, they can hear the music, guys, and they can also know about, you know, you guys as the musicians and as people. When I started doing, It was been some time ago, and I've told this story on the show before, but I was walking the dogs. This is years ago, and I wasn't a fan of Meatloaf. I didn't know much about the band. I heard the songs on the radio, but I heard an interview about the guy. And when I heard this interview, and this has to be quite a few years ago, I automatically liked him, and I started listening to his music. And I thought, wow, I didn't know anything about him. And once I started to find out a little bit about him and about what he'd been through and what he had, the sacrifices he made for his music, that kind of made me appreciate it more. So,
yeah, I actually watched or read an article about Meatloaf, how he's like a crazy investor and entrepreneur. Like it had nothing to do with his music. It was just all about his business savvy. It was pretty interesting.
Yeah. Don't you guys think that's kind of cool? And that's what I like to do in these shows is for people to see, okay, I hear this band, Rebel House Radio, and I hear about this guy, Mike Mangan and Mike Blumberg. But what I like to do is, okay, what about you guys? What is it that, you know, you've decided you're obviously talented, but it takes a lot to be able to dedicate your life to music and to take that risk and to put the music out there. I have full respect for that. And I just want tonight, if we can do that, let's start off. Well, let's start off with Mike Mangan and kind of go from the beginning, Mike, about, you know, what your family life was like. And did you grow up in a musical family, and how do you contribute your musical career back to that? I mean, I look back at my life and how it was, you know, I was raised in a musical family. My mother was very talented. There's always music playing. And I think that was kind of a salvation for me. I want to know what you got for you. So let's start off, Mike. What was it like growing up?
Well, it's a very interesting point, and I kind of agree with everything you said, even about the history of other musicians in their lives. But, I mean, for me personally, I'm an accident. I come from a big Irish Catholic family, basically, and I'm the youngest kid, and I think I was an accident. So I got a couple different generations of influences. My parents loved jazz. So I got a huge chunk of influence from them, from everything from Count Basie and Stan Kenton and Dizzy Gillespie and a guy named Gene Harris. And then my siblings, you know, they love rock music. So I got all that influence from them, the Beatles, Led Zeppelin, and all that kind of stuff growing up. So I really got a full palette of stuff. And then going to Catholic school, my piano teacher, when I started out, was a nun that played the pipe organ. Mm. And she was only like 4'9", but man, she was mean and she could play the hell out of that. I looking back on it right now, I think that probably planted a seed in my head, you know, ending up kind of specializing in the vintage Hammond organ. I definitely came from a music loving family, I had all those influences growing up, and there's no doubt that played a part in molding me.
Now, one thing I wanted to say, Mike, was, you know, I know your love for the Hammond B3 organ. Last week on my show, I had a Hammond B3 organist on, and I actually went to hear her play live today. Her name is Linda Dactyl, Dachtyl, and if you get a chance to check her out, I think you guys, it would be awesome. Sometimes I like doing that, you know, it's like, She is.
I love that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm just gonna say I love. You know, I'm kind of a music history nerd, so I've probably read 20 books on the history of classical piano players, the history and the lives of my favorite jazz musicians and stuff like that. And no matter how much you think you know about a subject, there's always something out there that you don't know. So, and the Hammond organ playing community, especially the people that play the real ones, kind of a smaller community, so I always love to find out about other players that I wasn't aware of before. So that's fantastic.
Yeah, she's I'm in the Columbus, Ohio area, and she's here, and I'd heard of her for a long time, and I just really was impressed with, you know, she does a lot of she taught at some of the colleges around here, and it kind of is interesting when you were talking about your music teacher and your piano teacher. She was I ask sometimes about people that were influential in your life, and she came right up immediately with her piano teacher, and you did too. And it was like, absolutely, you know, it's like those people, I think it's pretty cool because you got school and you got athletics and you got all these other things going on and you got, you know, you got to get your math and your English and everything. But sometimes it was with me. I mean, my choir director, I think she was pretty much like you're saying, Mike. She was about 4 foot nothing, and she was something else. The first day in our before that our choir director was, I don't think she really cared a whole lot about what was going on, so all the kids did was goof around and learned a couple songs, right. But when this one came in, she pointed right at me on that day one or day two and said, I want you to sing it all by yourself, the whole thing through.
Right on the spot, huh? Yeah, I actually remember my first piano recital, I forgot the song halfway through. And God bless this guy's soul. It was like 10 seconds of silent awkwardness, and this one guy started clapping in the background.
There you go.
And then everyone started clapping. And I think I started crying and ran back to my mom in the back seat back there, but...
speaking of that too, Mike Mangan was also played football in college. So he's got a total dichotomy.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, and I think
I've been involved. Go ahead, sorry, John.
Yeah, when you're talking, I guess, you know, we'll go into this real quick because this is a subject that I talk about a lot, and it means a lot to me. You know, with athletics and with music and things, and you know. In education right now, my wife and I, we've raised 5 kids, and we've seen all kinds of, you know, everyone's different. What was it for you? Let's stay with Mike Mangan for a minute. When, you know, you're taking the piano lessons and you're in athletics and things like that, was there anything in that realm? Like what I'm getting at is there are some kids, and my daughter is a social worker, and she deals with kids a lot that just don't fit in. They're smart kids and they got a lot going for them, but they just don't fit in.
Right.
And music helps a lot with that. I mean, it gives them confidence. What do you think of that? I mean, I love talking about that.
I mean, I've seen kids, without going into too deep of a personal story about people, I know some kids that have been through some terrible things, and their one passion in life right now is music, and it's really a saving grace for them. And I just think with music, you can experience a certain kind of almost spiritual connection. You can create something that's your own that's never been created before. And I think sometimes when kids realize that, they realize how special it is. And I also think just learning music when you're young, whether you become a musician or not, I think it helps develop your brain in a certain way. And strengthen mental functions and stuff like that. So, but I absolutely agree. I mean, music is a saving grace for a lot of kids, and I've seen it, and I continue to see it.
Yeah, there's a program in Columbus, Ohio. I don't know if it's you guys are in the Los Angeles area now. It's called the Dick and Jane Project. Have you heard of that?
It sounds really familiar. Sounds familiar, actually.
Yeah, what they do with I love the whole thing. I want to have them on the show. I haven't done it yet, but they go into the inner cities, and they go into the schools where the kids are. You know, some of them are having some problems and some troubles with their lives, and they hook them up with musicians in the Columbus area, and they write lyrics about their lives. They write, you know, whether it's poetry, and then they take that and turn that into songs, and they can hear a song by professional musicians about their lives. That's pretty cool.
That's really cool.
That's amazing. Yeah. And, you know, in this world, I mean, there's, 7 billion people in the world right now, and you think of the expanse of human history that's gone before us and how gigantic the world is and how many people there have been. But if you write a set of lyrics that are your own, no one's ever done that before. That's unique to you.
Yeah,
and
that's awesome.
I think
that's a good point.
That's a special thing about being able to create something as well, is that you can do something that no one else has ever quite done before.
Now,
and
Mike,
the way you play a note too, you know, can be completely, totally unique to you, even though it's the same note that 50 gazillion other people have played.
Right. And the, and with those kids and their life story so far and those lyrics, that's unique to them. And that's a special thing to put that into a tangible piece of art, you know? So that, that's
yeah.
pretty amazing.
If I remember, I'll send you guys the song. It's called $2 Date, and it's this girl met this guy from her school at the movies to go to the cinema, and he came to the date with $2, and that's and she wrote this, she wrote the song about that, and it was so good. It was like I'll try to send that over to you guys, but I think it, it's that's that kind of stuff means a lot to me. And so let's talk to Mike M just for a few more minutes about that. So when you're growing up and you're in a large family and you've got, you know, the athletics playing, you know, in college football, I mean, that's a lot of time. That takes a lot of time. And then also, where did music fit into that? Because, you know, I've been to college, sent the kids to college. It was hard for me just to go to college without anything like, you know, football or anything else like that. How was that, I mean, to cultivate even the musical part of that?
I mean, I played music since I was a little kid, so before I did anything else. So that was just always there for me. And you can get something out of, for me, you can get something out of music that you can't, I can't get out of anything else. It's like a spiritual experience, for lack of a better word. You know, I can experience a certain kind of kundalini, I guess you could say. You get goosebumps when you're playing, you know, and it's just a high level of artistic achievement for human beings to be able to express themselves that way. So it just was always something that was very special to me. I always had a piano or a keyboard with me, no matter where I lived, and it just never left.
Mike, what kind of Hammond are you playing now, like when you play live?
Well, it's funny you ask, because that's very special to me as well. And I'm from Milwaukee, so I'm from back in your part of the neck of the woods there.
Yeah, that's not
far. And I bought my Hammond organ from a guy named Bob Kames in Milwaukee. And if people are not familiar with Bob Kames, he's credited with writing the Chicken Dance.
Oh,
which,
everybody knows that.
Everybody, I mean, that kind of, you know, he was shocked when that song got put out there, I guess, how well it did, and that afforded him the ability to open up a music store. And, you know, he played with Lawrence Welk, I think, and he comes from that era of musicians. And I bought my Hammond from him, and my Leslie, I play a Hammond D3. It's about a 1960, and I got about a 1973 Leslie, and that's my main rig that I still play today. I had to get a lot of work done to it. I kind of got it customized so I can run guitar pedals through it. I like to put wah-wahs and stuff like that on the Hammond. But, yeah, that's my main rig, and that's what I've lugged to a lot of gigs. And it's been played by a lot of different people at this point, and it's a very, very, very special.
It's got the mojo.
Special,
it's got the mojo. Right?
It's a very special rig to me, and that will always be my axe forever.
How difficult is it to get it to gigs?
It is not easy. It's just like anything else, man. You got to have the right equipment. You have to have dollies. And, I mean, you know, a lot of guys did this before I did, going all the way back to Jimmy Smith, the great jazz organ player. I think Jimmy Smith actually used to he cut the legs off of his, maybe. I think he drove it around in a hearse for a while to gigs. But it's like anything else, man. The more you do it, and the more you understand how to use leverage and move it and stuff like that, the easier it gets. I mean, I'm kind of on autopilot with it right now.
Yeah, you can see the places that we've gotten that Hammond into and out of over the years.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. But I actually put a video out on YouTube a few years ago, kind of a time-lapse video of me moving the whole Hammond organ to a gig out here in L.A., to kind of show what you have to do in order to move it. And as a tribute to all the guys that have done it before I've done it. But it's heavy. It weighs 350 pounds. And I think the Leslie is about 150. But if you got the right dollies, I got this crazy ramp that my keyboard tech, Ken Rich, made. And I got all the right equipment to do it. So it's hard, but it's worth it.
Yeah, that's pretty cool because I know, you know, some people are using more modern, you know, types styles
Like Nord
of.
Electro, yeah, like
Yeah.
smaller versions, right?
The issue with that to me is, for instance, in the song you just played, Can't Say No, in the very beginning, the first thing you hear is the bass, and then there's something that sounds like an explosion. I don't
Right.
know if you noticed that. It's called
Yep.
thunderclaps. You can only do that on a real Hammond. John Lord used to do it in Deep Purple, and Keith Emerson used to do it in Emerson, Lake & Palmer. It's because
Right.
you have a spring reverb unit and an 8-tube preamp inside the Hammond. If you crank that reverb all the way up and shake the Hammond, it causes that microphonic feedback, and you get that explosion sound. You can't do that on a solid-state synthesizer. Just not going to happen. So there's all these idiosyncrasies to a real Hammond, and that you can only get out of the real thing.
Yeah,
So,
that's really interesting too, because I mean that means that you're a real purist. You talked about John Lord and all the things that he did. It was amazing. I went to see Deep Purple this past Wednesday. You know, John Lord's passed, but I don't know if you know who Don
yep.
Airey is. Don Airey is
Oh
the
yeah.
keyist. Yeah. Oh, he's good. He's really good. Man, that was like
Absolutely,
a
man.
yeah. That was like an amazing concert. I'd never seen him before, and I was telling my wife, I'm not getting any younger, and neither are any of these bands, so I'm gonna go when they're coming
Wow,
through.
man.
Yeah, I'm
Hey,
going.
who was singing with you? Who was singing with him?
The lead,
Was it Glenn
he,
Hughes?
no, the lead singer for Deep Purple was Ian Gillan, the original guy.
So he got you. And like the second incarnation was Glenn Hughes. That band's been through so many incarnations. It's amazing.
Yeah, I know Ian's been
But
with them for a long time, and he it was pretty impressive because I know those guys are pushing 70, if they're
oh
not.
yeah,
Yeah,
absolutely.
and I think this is a good thing to talk about too because, you know, they got on stage and they played for 2 hours straight, and Ian Gillan was his vocal chops were amazing. He was hitting. The range was just incredible, and he sang the whole entire time. And you know, like Ian Paice, the drummer, played like a 12, 13-minute drum solo. I mean, these guys, I'm telling you, I was impressed with
Well,
that.
you know, I might as well just bring this up, Mike, because just I got hired last November.
Excuse me.
There's a band called Kings of Chaos, and it's the Guns N' Roses rhythm section. And they kind of have a revolving door on the band. They got Billy Gibbons sitting in sometimes, and they even have Steven Tyler sit in, and Nino Benkort. And they have Glenn Hughes from Deep Purple, is basically their main singer right now. And through a good fortune, I got recommended to play a gig with those guys. It was this
Wow.
award show, and they actually hired me to play Burn by Deep Purple,
Oh,
if
cool.
you've ever heard that song. And I had to cover all the John Lord organ parts, which, if you listen to that song, it's definitely not easy.
Yeah.
A little tricky,
Like
but
Clockwork Orange, like
yeah, but
mind-bending classical
it's
thing.
mind-bending stuff that I had to shut out for a while, but it was just a great honor, and they wanted me to bring my real Hammond. They wanted the real Hammond, not a simulator, because in partially John Lord does that thing in that song that I was talking about when he takes the organ
Right.
solo,
Cool.
the thunderclaps. Yeah, so I am very familiar with Deep Purple and one of my
Yeah,
favorite
must have
bands.
been an awesome show, I'm sure.
It was amazing. It was like, to me, you know, I think you guys can relate to this as being, you know, professional musicians. These guys started when they were in their 20s, and they literally haven't really stopped. And they don't know anything
Yeah.
else.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I don't think you ever really do stop. I
Well,
mean,
that's the great thing about music. And then, you know, look at the Stones for crying out loud.
yeah. Yeah,
Yeah, just keep
it was
going.
a
And often,
Yeah, go
yeah,
ahead.
oftentimes you get better because you gain experience and
Yeah, I'd say
as you go on.
you 100% get better. I mean, some people change, you know, but I just heard that I think Cream is playing again together for the first time in like 25 years, and that was one of the first bands that I was ever exposed to. So, you know, that would be pretty exciting because that's the Eric Clapton that like I'm a huge fan of. You know, I think
Right.
he changed and became a different musician over time. You know, but for me, it was more about the stuff when he was reckless abandon and didn't care what he was coming out with and everything. But anyway, that's
right.
Another conversation.
Well, yeah, I wish we could go see Beethoven live. That would be cool.
Yeah, that'd be sick.
Yeah, that would be good. They probably would do that. They brought Michael Jackson back, so didn't they, with some kind of hologram? Yeah.
Tupac.
They could,
yeah.
Yeah.
Tupac. I actually saw the Tupac show at Coachella a couple years ago. Yeah.
How was that?
I mean, it was pretty. The three-dimensional hologram was pretty cool. I got to admit.
He was on point. He sounded just like the record. It was amazing.
He was having a good night. Oh, that's
yeah.
Yeah.
My guests are Mike Mangan and Mike Blumberg from the band Rebel House Radio, and you can go on their website, rebelhouseradio.com. Their latest release is One More Day, and we played a song from that. Guys, let's play another song. I like to play Soul Remedy. I like that. Can you talk about that before we play it?
Sure. I guess as far as the lyrical content or just the whole overall putting together the song.
The whole thing, the whole shebang.
The whole shebang. Well, that was written quite a while ago when we were playing with a different drummer, and it's just a little melody I had, and I didn't really have lyrics. It kind of brought the chord structure and the melody in. And then Mike started putting all these guitar parts to it, and I didn't even have the chorus melody, and one of the guys in the band at the time didn't like the melody I had. So I'm like, all right, fair enough. I respect your opinion. And I went home, and I kept trying to come up with a different melody, which ended up being the chorus melody in this now. But the only lyrics I could come up at that point in time was, I need a good melody. So those were the original lyrics to the song. And that's how that melody ended up coming about. But, you know, then we brought it back in, and this is one of the ways me and Mike work together and we write songs. And he brought it in, and he kind of twisted up the rhythm of the guitar part and the verse a little bit. And we worked out the arrangement together and a little breakdown. You know, he came up with the guitar line behind that. And we kind of spent probably a good couple months, you know, working on this song amongst other songs, and to get it to its final state. And then when we tracked it, we probably did a lot of takes of it and picked the best one. So
then there's also the awesome, you know, in my opinion, one of my favorite parts of the song is kind of when the Hammond starts doing, when the Hammond is soloing at the end, and it kind of references the chorus melody. I really love, like, that's probably my favorite part of it, is that Hammond kind of riff that he does at the end. It really sounds pretty sick. Sonically, I think this song turned out really, really huge. So.
Right.
Well, let's play it. This is Rebel House Radio, and we'll be right back with the rest of the interview with the guys right after this.
Blow away the pain.
And we're back with John Talk Radio on a Saturday night, August the 8th, 2015. My guests are Mike Mangan and Mike Blumberg from the band Rebel House Radio. You can go on their website, rebelhouseradio.com. You can get their record right from there, their album from there. I believe, guys, you have the full album, and then they can get 5 songs or 2 songs.
We do have. You can buy the album that way directly from us, but there's also a link on the homepage right to you to iTunes and CD Baby. You can get it, or you know, we actually will be on Pandora pretty soon too, so you'll be able to buy tracks from there.
Well, we could talk forever about the music industry, but what I wanted to do, Mike, is talk to Mike Blumberg about how, you know, it was when you were growing up and how music influenced you and some of your influences, and just talk about that a little bit so we can get a history of how you grew up with and became a musician.
Sure. So I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland. You know, really crazy thing that I'll preface this whole story with is that when my father was born, he was born in a house in North Hollywood, California. And when he turned 6, his father and mother and he and his sister moved to Baltimore from California. And long story short, when I ended up coming out to Los Angeles, I met a drummer initially on Craigslist from a friend of mine. And the studio he had that I ended up rehearsing in for several years was right, like, within a quarter mile where my father was born. So it was just crazy that I came full circle back to California.
On the same street, too, right?
Yeah,
on the same street.
A quarter mile away on the same exact street. So anyway,
that's amazing.
So I grew up in Baltimore, and when I was 2, so my grandmother, my father's mother, was an opera singer who had perfect pitch, and you know, she was really talented. And then when I was born, when I was 2 years old, I started playing a Beatles song on the piano with no training. Which my parents thought was a little crazy. So in Baltimore, they have the Peabody Conservatory. So my parents immediately put me in there, and I started taking piano lessons and did pretty well. And then when I was around 11 or 12, unfortunately, when I was 10, I lost my mother. She passed away, and she was a huge, you know, positive influence in my life. And she used to play folk guitar, and, you know, she loved, my family did love music. Like I said, my father, Cream was one of the first bands that my father introduced me to. Classic rock music, and I had that classical influence from Peabody. And then my mom and my dad, my mom was into, like, the most popular music of the time. And so when I was around 11 or 12, my brother was actually playing guitar. He had started playing guitar a little bit. And he does, you know, he has some musical ability, but he's not, you know, he really wasn't willing to put in the time, the effort. So at that point, so I would go into his room and steal his guitar when he wasn't there and just start messing around. And I kind of quickly surpassed him and just, you know, started soaking in everything. Right around that time, I also, you know, so I already was really into classic rock music and stuff like that. And even Steve Winwood with some of the more modern stuff at that point. And, you know, some others. But I got into Led Zeppelin around 12 or 13, and I went and bought literally every week. My dad would take me to the store, and I'd get another Led Zeppelin album, just soak in every single. So bottom line is I had perfect pitch. I mean, I just soaked in everything that I learned and was, you know, primarily self-taught. I had some guitar lessons for about a year and a half when I was, like, 14, and then but primarily it was classical music and then, you know, classic rock music and some pop stuff. And then when I went to high school, and I started actually playing in bands when I was about 14 or so, I went to these summer camps for a couple of weeks in the summer, and they had a music program. So I started playing in actual bands and performing, which I really loved. And then when I was in high school, I started playing in some bands there and with some guys that were in college, and I was a little younger. We were, you know, I was getting into some live performance there. And then college, I kind of started to get more into jazz, and I took some jazz lessons there. I majored in business in college, but I was, you know, my father was a doctor, so he really, you know, wanted me to have that background to, you know, just in case kind of thing. So I decided to do that. At first was music and then kind of switched to business in the second half. But when I did that, I played jazz in the big band in college, and jazz combo, and I took some lessons there. And then right around that time, I also really started getting into kind of like John Scofield and the jazz stuff and the groove stuff and the, you know, the kind of the jam band scene, you know, in high school and college, Fish and you know, Grateful Dead and stuff like that. So I've always really been into really ethereal, you know, wall of sound style music that just, you know, production and how things are put together. And so after college, I went to audio engineering school and learned how to do that for a year. And then I came out to L.A. after that. So, and I actually was working in music licensing for a little while, too, before I came out to L.A. But so for me, you know, it was a lot of kind of some lessons, but a lot of just listening to musicians and soaking up what they do. And, you know, that's kind of how I got to this point where I am. But I've always known, you know, that music is the one thing that I have, you know, an ability to do, really. And it was given to me. And, you know, I hear music like I hear English, basically. That's just the way it is for me naturally. So I know this is what I'm supposed to be doing, you know.
Yeah, when Mike says he has perfect pitch, he really has real perfect pitch, meaning I could play a 10-note chord on the piano for him, and he could tell me every single note in the chord instantaneously.
Yeah, that's
with my eyes closed. With my eyes closed.
it's pretty astounding. I wish I had that, because when I've gotten hired to do session to learn songs, if I had perfect pitch, I would just have to listen to them one time and I'd know it.
But it can be a curse, though, too, because you know, you put a capo on a guitar and it messes with my head a little bit until I get used to it. But you know, but it's been, you know, so for me, you know, I just loved I love groove oriented music and rock and roll and melodic stuff, and I think, you know, I'm gonna be for the rest of my life on the quest to be able to become a better and better songwriter, and, you know, focus on the elements that really make a song good, and I think everyone would like to do that, but I think it's really important to, like, have fun while you're doing it and enjoy every day. And, you know, Mike and I are on this kind of steamroll upward spiral in a positive way with Rebel House Radio, but we've had great experiences leading up to this. And we were just talking about the other night that it's important to, you know, appreciate everything that has happened thus far in our lives. And, you know, you have challenges and you have ups and downs, but if you stay positive and just kind of keep pushing in the right direction, eventually, you know, things are going to happen. So,
right.
Yeah, that's
sorry. I went on a little bit of a tangent there. I thought
that's a lot of awesome stuff there. I mean, first of all, I'm thinking, okay, so you sneak into your brother's room and his guitar and start playing it. What kind of guitar was it?
It was a Mexican Fender Strat. It's made in Mexico. Yeah. And the funny thing is, like, now, I've kind of, over the last couple of years, I've kind of built up a little arsenal of guitars that I've customized. And, you know, you think about guitars like that. When I was a little kid, I was like, oh, you know, this thing is, like, it's okay. But, you know, I wouldn't, like, want to play one of those, like, as my guitar, like, as I got older. And then I'm just, you know, now that I look back, I have three guitars that were made in Mexico that are Fenders that I just completely gutted and customized. And they're amazing. You know, as long as the neck feels good and you put the right pickups and hardware in there, I mean, you don't have to spend, you know, $3 gazillion to get a really good guitar. So, yeah, it was a Fender Strat, white Fender Strat, white pickguard, maple neck, Mexican, you know, totally reminded me of Hendrix. And, you know, I love Hendrix and the classic rock, all those great players. So, yeah.
Well, what's your gig like when you set up? We know Mike M with his Hammond B3. What do you set up with, Mike B?
So I have, yeah. So now with Rebel House Radio, because I've been, like, kind of beefing up this rig, I tend, so far, every time we've played, I've brought all five of my guitars. I have one Strat that I use just for E-flat. So I always have that there. And then I have a Gibson 336, which is amazing, you know, solid piece of mahogany, hollow body, kind of in between the 335 and the Les Paul as far as size. And because the Les Pauls are really heavy, so I wanted something that was real versatile and not as quite as heavy. So then I have an SG that I kind of customized, and then I have a Tele as well, and then another Strat that has a single coil, so you can get the Hendrix tones and all kinds of stuff, and the whammy bar and all that. So I have that, excuse me, and then for years now, I had two pedal boards that I use a number of different crazy effects and loops. I've used a boomerang for a long time, and then I've consolidated to a new board that I just got built within the last, I think, 6 months, and it's just amazing. I got, you know, all different kinds of effects and loops, and even have, like, a Leslie pedal effect, which maybe, you know, I'm not trying to make Mike jealous with my ability to play to sound like a Leslie, but, you know, in certain,
how dare you?
In certain instances, it's pretty cool. And then I've always, for the last, like, 15 years or so, I've had just played out of a Fender 410 DeVille that I've had ever since, like, college era. But I actually, just, like, recently at a show we had, I smashed a tube by accident, and that led me on this journey to buy a new amp, which I got a couple of days ago, and I just picked up this amazing, the guy that works on my amps for me told me about it. It's a 1967 Fender Pro Reverb in, like, excellent condition, and it's a 212, And it's like the best sounding, warmest amp I've ever heard in my entire life. So that is definitely going to be my rig for the rest of my life. And the guitars, you know, I feel like I have everything now that I need. So that it is a little bit of gear to carry, you know, take into a show, but it's in order to get the right tones and do what you want to do, you just have to make sacrifices, right?
All right.
Yeah, and you got to know what it is that you feel comfortable with. I think that's awesome. Now, one thing I wanted to talk to you guys about was your careers of, you know, you've had different careers. What is it that brought you guys together and made you this to work together, and how is it that you work together? Because it's not an easy thing to do. And I think, Mike,
yeah,
you were talking about the song you were writing and somebody was saying, well, you need to work on the melody. I've been in bands before. I know what it's like to think, well, you know, we got to go down the path, but everybody's going down different paths. And what is it?
Yeah,
it's talk
so
about that.
And I could
go ahead.
I could just say, me and Mike have played together for years. We had different bands before this one. I had a band called Big Organ Trio, which was actually like an instrumental organ trio, like Booker T. Meets Hendrix kind of thing. And Mike had another band called Revolutionary Side Effects. And we met one night. I think you got one of my shows, I think, Mike.
I was asked by a bass player that we auditioned. My old band, my old drummer and I decided, you know, we just auditioned him. We were like, oh, he didn't have any real, like, a ton of effects and stuff. And we were like, oh, he's not a perfect guy for us. But he was really good. And he let us know about Mike's band. So I went to go sit in with Mike's band on guitar. And that's when I met him the first time.
And then we talked till like 4 in the morning about Stevie Ray Vaughan and Hendrix. And we just hit it off. And we've been really good friends ever since. And during those years, you know, I'd go sit in with them at their shows. He'd come and sit in with me at my shows and so forth. So as things evolved, eventually, this band, Rebel House Radio, started as a different band. It was just a fun thing on the side that we wanted to start with no pressure. It was just me, Mike, and this other drummer. And it was a fun thing in the beginning. We recorded a little EP, and we started playing gigs with that. And, you know, it started to evolve. And we finally crossed a threshold where we wanted to seriously focus on songwriting and set goals and get things done and kind of take it to the next level. And that's where we had difficulty with the other member, because, you know, it's one thing to sit in a rehearsal room and come up with new stuff and jam out. It's a different thing to get stuff done. You know, we want to have...
You would think that like with three people in a project, it would be easy because you could just vote, which is what Mike and I, you know, that was our theory about it. But the other person we were involved with was like, you know, you guys are going to vote against me and, you know, it's not really going to be fair. To me, that's the most fair it could possibly be.
Yeah, I mean, you know, everyone's opinion is valid, but at some point, if you want to finish a song, you got to have a goal, you got to set a deadline, and if one guy doesn't like it but the other two do, it's a, you know, a democracy in that sense, and the only way stuff will get done. And some people are resistant to that, and me and Mike are on the exact same page with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Not only musically, but as far as setting goals and working our butts off, staying up till around the clock, not getting any sleep to get stuff done to meet our deadlines. We've done that countless times when we were recording this album and preparing it to get mixed. So, I mean, we have the musical side there, but the whole other side of the business side of things and setting goals and making sure you push yourself to get them done, we're on the exact same page with that stuff. And I think that's why we can work together so well.
You know,
it's hard to find.
Every note on this record was recorded, engineered, produced by Mike and I together, you know. So we had to put in a lot of hours working together. We had to, you know, write all the songs first and spec them out and get them over to our drummer and then, you know, do all the scratch recordings of everything and then come back and track everything. And we did some recording in his house and my house. And, you know, I mean, it really was a Herculean effort that we went through to get it done. And it was... you know, it just ended up sounding really, really amazing. So, but it's definitely, it's a ton of work to make something like a 14 song rock and roll album. Like, you know, some of the songs have like 60 tracks on them, you know, so.
Right. And we're also not afraid of the minutia. You know, we use Google Drive. We have Excel documents, Word documents, hundreds of them at this point of all the tracks that had to get done. Everything's organized, you know.
It's like
because
a business. It needs to be
like
a business.
That's
how you have to treat it. That way.
If you don't, you'll forget stuff, you get lost, and you won't meet the deadlines you set for yourself, and stuff will not get done. And, you know, so we're on the same page with all that stuff.
But that's not, it's not that way for everyone, obviously. I mean, it's just, that's why certain bands work, certain bands don't. I was just listening to, you know, Howard Stern, I think, the other day, and they were talking about the Stones and how, you know, they stay together versus other bands. And it's just, it's, we're not robots. It would be great if we were, we all were robots and everyone could just walk up to the gig. It's like Mike and I talk about having this guy named Band Lord, and he's like this robot guy that just does anything that we need. Like, if he needs us, if we need him to book us gigs or go load all our gear in, it's like he's just a robot. He has an incredible strength. He can do anything he wants to do, and anything we need. If one of our band members gets sick or can't play a show, he just sits in and plays their. He's already memorized exactly how they play. You know, it's like that utopia will never happen. So you have to also learn how to work with other people. You have to learn in every part of life, in my opinion. You have to learn how to listen to other people. It isn't about everything that you feel needs to happen all the time or you think. In music especially, I mean, it's about you have to make the greater thing sound as great as possible. And, you know, music at its most basic point is nothing, and it all builds from there. So
right.
It just, you have to be grounded, and you have to make sure that you're open to the possibility of maybe you don't know everything and that you're working with other people for a common good. You know?
Right.
And that's the only way to approach it.
And I'll sum it up with one quote my brother gave me, actually, which I thought was great. Too much analysis equals paralysis.
That's right. T-Mac.
You know, at some point, something has to be good enough to be completed, I guess you could say, because musicians tend to scrutinize things to death, and it can go on forever.
Well, that was going to be my next question, because I've talked to people that have been in the studio for so long because of that exact thing. And it's like, well, it's almost there. It's just about right. And, you know, you at some point you have to make that decision. And I think it's interesting too, guys, because if you go back, you talk, you know, about Cream and some of the classic bands that recorded a lot of the, some of those guys recorded live. They didn't use a lot of tracking.
Oh, yeah.
And I, you know, I've listened to music. People will come to me and say, well, what do you think of this? And listen to some pretty basic raw stuff from like in the 60s that wasn't put together that well, but it has some kind of magic to it. It has a vibe.
That's what, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I could give you a specific example right now. Miles Davis, Milestones, go listen to the famous recording of that. It slows down by like 10 beats by the end of the song that it started at. And Miles Davis hits a complete flub on the trumpet in one of the last heads of the song. But the overall take, the vibe is so good that none of those details mattered, you know? I mean, Beethoven has the quote, you know, a mistake is nothing, but playing without passion is inexcusable. So I think in the pursuit of perfection, people can get lost in that. And you're never going to achieve that, and if you try, you can lose some of the heart and passion in a performance, you know?
You know, and one thing I'll say about that was, you know, during the recording process, I mean, you're right. It's like knowing that you have the ability to go back and undo and redo a million times if you wanted to. There was one guitar solo, I think, on a song called Trouble Out of Mind on this record, and I was, you know, it was just like, I'm really stoked about the guitar solo, and when we first went to record it, because I actually went back and re-recorded a bunch of the guitars on the record. I got the new guitar, the 336, and I wanted to get that tone on there. So I went back and re-recorded a couple of songs. But when we did Trouble Out of Mind, at the end, I tried to do it. I did a bunch of solos, probably 20 or 30 solos, and just not one of them hit it the way I wanted. And so I kind of put it off. And then when the last, I think it was one of the last things I did for the record of the recording the guitars, right before the security guard came, in the complex where I live, and said, you know, you guys got to stop making noise. It was like the last guitar solo or something. But I did it, and it was like I tried to do it that day. I hadn't done it. I took a little break. And the first one, I'm pretty sure I nailed it, and that was the one. And it's just because, you know, maybe there's too much, like, same thing, T-Math, too much analysis equals paralysis. And, you know, you got to just trust in yourself that maybe the first one is the one that's the one, and that's it, you know. It's one captured moment in time. It doesn't have to be the perfect thing. It's just one snapshot. So,
no, it's a great point. It's one of those things where, you know, when I'm talking to musicians about things, and I was listening to this one that was released in the 60s by this New York singer, Evie Sands. I don't know if you've ever heard of her, but I'd never heard the song before, and I listened to it. And you were talking, I think, and I got immediately goosebumps listening to her voice on this. And listening to it, it was live, and it wasn't that technical. It wasn't that great.
Right.
But, oh, my gosh, it was like right to your heart. It was, how do you do that?
it's amazing. You know, like I said, I'm kind of a nerd, and there's a concert pianist named Anton Rubinstein, and he was kind of famous. He had really short, thick fingers, and he would make a lot of mistakes, apparently, because of that. And someone wrote a little analysis of a concert they were at with this guy, and he messed up a piece. I forget the piece he was playing, and he got frustrated and stopped, and they said he started over and played it with the greatest exactness, is how they put it. And they said he didn't make any mistakes on the second take, but it lost all the passion that he had when he played it the first time.
Yeah,
and
that makes sense.
So I think, sometimes when you concentrate too much on the technical side of things, you lose all the feel and the heart and the soul in something.
So when you guys are in the studio,
that's more important.
Yeah, when you're in the studio and you're laying the tracks down and you're concentrating, you're doing, you know, your best to make it sound the way you want to. Do you also in the back of your mind, guys, thinking about how is this going to translate live?
How's it going to translate live?
Yeah.
Oh yes. So we like literally. This whole record was written for the studio, so we had never done this live. So after we recorded the album, we got a rehearsal room together, and we were in there for months. Like, just literally, we actually took the tracks from the record and we created comps, because our drummer and bass player, our drummer lives in Vegas, Ryan Krieger, who's amazing. He played on most of the record, so we didn't really have a band together yet before we played the shows, the first couple shows that we've had so far. So we actually literally just comped from the record the bass and drum tracks, and we sat in the studio for months, like, you know, 3-4 nights a week, just learning all the songs and learning, because I had, you know, some songs had 6 different guitar parts in them. I mean, you're exactly right. Like, how am I going to pull that off live? And
yeah,
you have to figure out, you know, how am I going to use what I have? And we really were able to do it, you know, because we work so well together, we're able to make it happen. But it is a challenge, for sure.
But the challenge, and it takes a lot of time and effort to do. And then, you know, live, we extend parts and songs and we add new things and so forth. So the shows are not just regurgitations of the album at all.
And the interesting thing also is that now we're writing new songs. Since we started to play live now, we're writing new songs that are getting developed for the live show and not for the album. So it ends up being completely different approach, which is pretty interesting.
Well guys, it's been absolutely awesome talking to you guys. I loved it.
You too, man. You too.
It's been so good. And my brother, Mike Blumberg, from the band Rebel House Radio, and you can go on their website, rebelhouseradio.com, and I highly recommend the album. And it's been great talking to you guys, and I wish you all the best.
Thanks, man.
Thank you so much.
We'd love to say also thanks to Cyber PR for hooking us up with you, and you know, make sure everybody go to the website and check out the music video that we just released for Can't Say No, which is like phenomenal music video directed by Michael Macara, unbelievably talented guy, and turned out really well. So check it out. Check out the rest of the album. Thank you so much. We were honored to be here, and it was a great conversation.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, guys, and have a great evening. And thanks, everyone, for listening to John Talk Radio tonight and supporting independent music. So everybody have a great evening, and we'll talk to you later.
All right.
Bye.
See ya. Bye-bye.
Love will lift you up. Love will break you down. Love will steal your heart. Love will steal your crown. When you're caving in, when you're down and out, searching for a sign, love will show you how. How could I see behind?